Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Too Much Information is a production of iHeartRadio. Everyone, and welcome to Too Much Information, the show that gives you the secret histories and little-known fascinating facts behind your favorite music, movies, TV shows, and more. My name's Jordan Runtog.
And I'm Alex Heigl.
Welcome back to the second in our two-part installment celebrating David Bowie's breakthrough album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, which turns 50 years old this very week. Now, Bowie broke so many boundaries and defied so many expectations, so in keeping with that same bold spirit of innovation, we're delivering our first two-part episode. We hope you enjoy it. How do you think it's going, Heigl?
I think you can map out the progress here with the rise and fall of my serotonin levels. I think we're killing it. I like to think of each one of us as different glam rock icons from the 70s.
Oh, who are you? Which glam rock icon are you?
I'm Iggy Pop during his terrible Berlin phase. Berlin, not really
not
glam.
The couch phase? Not the couch phase? But
who among us?
Right. Has not been Iggy Pop living on his ex-manager's couch. If you could be a phase of Bowie, what phase would you be?
Oh, gosh. Happy Bowie? Like, happily married to a supermodel and not caring about things, but before he had cancer? You mean like peak Bowie? Also David, also in Berlin doing a lot of coke.
Okay.
I've never been to Berlin.
Really?
Know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I would like to go there and do coke with Iggy Pop. And write Heroes, one of the best songs ever.
Who among us?
Yeah, what about you?
Oh, man. I mean, I would probably be Diamond Dogs era. I would probably be taking on a little too much, trying to do something that was a little too crazy, a little too ambitious that makes sense to nobody but me. So, yeah, probably okay. Diamond Dogs era, if I was honest with myself.
That tracks.
Yeah. I mean, in case this isn't obvious, and I know I mentioned this in the last episode, Bowie is someone who means a lot to me. If you'll allow me the shameless plug, I spent a year writing and researching a scripted biographical podcast for the folks at iHeart called Off the Record, David Bowie, which came out in early 2021 to mark the fifth anniversary of David's ascent to a new astral plane. So he's someone that I feel very passionate about. So please forgive me if I start to ramble.
No, it's a great podcast. Everyone should go listen to it. Jordan made himself, much like Bowie, insane on it, and much like Bowie's phase when he subsisted on red peppers, milk, and cocaine, Jordan subsisted on British candy, regional sodas, and seltzer. So,
yeah,
you know, we got the Berlin trilogy out of it, and you fine folks got an incredible podcast, so go listen to it.
But we're going to go deep on the Ziggy era for this one. In our first episode, we discussed the world that shaped Ziggy Stardust. Now we'll look at how Ziggy Stardust shaped the world, or at least a generation of artists.
Today, we're going to discuss how the Starman took flight, blasting Bowie into the upper echelon of the music world, setting a benchmark for rock and roll, theatricality, physicality, and pure imagination. Not to mention pure rock and roll excess. Oftentimes this took the form of glitter and cocaine, but sometimes a dark shadow and cocaine. We'll also take a look at Bowie's complex relationship with both his band and the LGBTQ community, meditate on the likelihood that he was a sex addict, explore his fascination with Japan, and explain why he ultimately killed off his most famous creation at the peak of Ziggy's popularity. So without further ado, here's everything else you didn't know about David Bowie's The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
So the Ziggy Stardust tour officially kicked off 4 months before the album came out on February 10th, 1972, at the Toby Jug Pub in London, which is a truly spectacular name for a pub, I have to say. It was definitely a humble start considering the stadiums that were to come. 60 people milled around in front of the 2-foot-high stage. David would later say, "Ziggy was a case of small beginnings. I remember when we had no more than 20 or 30 fans at most. They'd be down in the front and the rest of the audience was indifferent. And it feels special because you and the audience kid yourselves that you're in on this big secret. You feel kind of cool. It all gets so dissipated when you get bigger." Yeah, a lot of artists, I feel like when they play the bigger rooms like arenas and stadiums, start feeling like it's harder to make it feel like it's a group of friends or a clubhouse. Anyway. So the band, his Spiders from Mars, which we should say are Mick Ronson on guitar, Trevor Boulder on bass, and Woody Woodmansey on drums, the spectacular named Woody Woodmansey. The band spent the spring months crisscrossing England in cramped cars and vans, playing mostly empty clubs and college venues, and it was really not glamorous. They hauled their own gear and they peed in pub kitchen sinks. One time, a venue lost power in the middle of a gig, and David was forced to amuse the crowd by giving an impromptu rundown of his outfit to just kill time while they worked on getting the electricity back. Another time, David tried to crowd surf, as he'd seen his buddy Iggy Pop do, and there weren't enough people, and he fell flat on his face. So remember all this when we're talking about the, you know, $20,000 room service bills at the Beverly Hills Hotel and stuff later on, you know, in the next year or so. This is very humble beginnings, but slowly but surely, words started to spread and the audience started to swell, and The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars was released on June 16th, 1972. And as I said, it was a slow burn at first, selling 8,000 copies in its first week, which was respectable, but hardly earth-shattering. But then, in July of 72, there was one performance that would change everything.
Segway,
yes. And this was an appearance on the British television program Top of the Pops. And this show in England was kind of the Everest for every music act in the UK. Once you've been on Top of the Pops, you were officially a star. Everyone watched it. It was like their version of Ed Sullivan. And in a pre-digital age, this was one of the few opportunities you had to actually see your favorite artists, you know, when they weren't out on the road on tour. I love this. While Bowie and his band were waiting to go on, the staff at the BBC assumed that they were extras from Doctor Who because of their flamboyant Spiders from Mars outfit, which is great. But 7:30 p.m. on the night of July 6th, some 15 million people got their first look at Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. You know, Bowie's not one who really trades in cliches, but it really was a Star is Born kind of moment. And it's fitting for such a star-making performance. He played Starman, his latest single. And life would really never be the same for David again after this Top of the Pops performance. Just 2 days after the broadcast, the band performed a charity show at London's Royal Festival Hall, where David was introduced as, quote, "the next biggest thing to God." Which is a hell of an intro. And within a week of the performance on Top of the Pops, Starman, the single, entered the top 10. The Ziggy Stardust LP started flying off shelves. And by the end of the year, practically everything that David had ever done was charting. He'd done a number of albums before this that had all flopped upon its release. But all of a sudden, they entered the charts too. And fans started camping out outside of his home. One of these fans was a young boy, George, who would borrow make up
a lot,
yeah, quite a bit from David. So yeah, the Beatles had the Ed Sullivan Show, Bowie had Top of the Pops. Everything about it was just right. It was the right time. It was the right song. It was the right style. The day after the show aired, classrooms and playgrounds were abuzz with talk of this alien who had hijacked the BBC airwaves for 3.5 precious minutes. And not only did the show help launch David's career in the UK, but it also started an untold number of other musical careers. You had future members of U2, The Smiths, Joy Division, and so many more all watched this show and cited it as a major influence and a catalyst for wanting to jumpstart their own bands. So to say you changed lives with that performance isn't an understatement at all. And with Bowie's confident flamboyance, he'd issued a challenge that was important for younger people to see. If you want my talent, accept all of me, makeup and all. And he was good enough that people did. And his triumph was really a triumph for anyone who ever felt like an outcast. And it kind of made him, really for the rest of his career, the patron saint of the weird.
Yeah. And again, we can't underscore enough the fact that homosexuality had been on the books legal for just 5 years in the UK at this point. But it, you know, it wasn't like a switch had suddenly flipped. There's a book called Glitter Up the Dark by Sasha Geffen, who notes that plenty of gay men were still being arrested for consensual sex acts. They quote an LGBTQ activist named Peter Tatchell, who said in 2017 that the partial decriminalization of homosexuality in 1967 was very partial indeed. But in July that year, 2,000 people marched through London in the UK's first ever Pride rally. So progress was incremental.
And it's strange to think about now. You mentioned how it wasn't like a switch was flicked. The acceptance in the mainstream culture was very gradual. The thing that raised the most eyebrows about David's performance on Top of the Pops wasn't his crazy outfit, wasn't his effete makeup, but it was a moment that I when I rewatch this clip, doesn't even register with me. It's the moment when the band launches into the Starman chorus. David goes over to guitarist Mick Ronson and casually drapes his arm around him, and they pull each other close so they can sing together. And viewers today, I really don't think would think twice about seeing such an act. But in the early 70s in England, such physical contact between men, especially men who were dressed like that, was shocking. I mean, you know, they got people wondering, could these men and drag adjacent outfits be a couple? Gasp.
I say. Yeah, I am also struck in that performance by it's such a common, obvious thing that you see people do all the time, but the way that he points right into the camera,
yeah,
and says, I had to phone someone, so I picked on you. It's such a meaningful thing that kids in the UK would have looked at and been like, oh my God.
Like, oh, that was what they all cite, that moment. They really
I
felt
love it
like,
so much.
Oh, it's so good.
But so, you know, we do have to talk about David's courting of the queer vote, which is a polite way of putting the fact that he treated the public perception of his sexuality charitably as another thing that he could kind of pick up and use. You know, on the cover of Man Who Sold the World, he's lounging on a piece of furniture in the quote man dress from a British designer named Mr. Fish, who I believe Mick Jagger would also shop from at one point. But the other big bomb he drops around this time is months before the Top of the Pops performance in February of 1972. He's giving an interview to Melody Maker, which is one of the biggest British music is that a tabloid? Would you call it a tabloid? Music
no,
publications.
Yeah, I think it's a, yeah. That and New Musical Express, NME.
Yeah,
I
NME.
Think were like kind of the two.
But, well, it hasn't, this part hasn't aged well. Michael Watts described David as rock's swishiest outrage. A gorgeously effeminate boy who's as camp as a row of tents.
This is in his article for Melody Maker?
Yeah. Yeah, swish was kind of like a soft slur back then.
Yeah,
too. Not a great thing to see in print. But so anyway, the pull quote from the interview is Bowie saying, "I'm gay and always have been, even when I was David Jones." And then he shoots down the fact that he may have been doing this to court controversy. He says, "I'm not outrageous. I'm David Bowie," and which is a great quote.
That's a great
admittedly,
quote.
He did have a way with a soundbite. And it, predictably, it caused an enormous deluge in the press. There were very few, if any, openly gay musicians in England at the time. And coming out in the pages of a print publication, much less one of the publications, was really just a move that didn't have any precedent. And also the fact that David had a wife and kid, who is, in her own way, kind of a celebrity at this point, too. Angie was like, she was a bit of a fashion star, right? Am I telling tales out of school there?
Angie, no, I mean, she kind of, I mean, part of the reason that they ended up breaking up was that she felt like they had kind of a mutual understanding that they would focus on making David a pop star. And then once he was up on that ledge, he would pull her up and she would be an actress, raconteur, cultural provocateur kind of type figure. And then he got so caught up in his own world that he sort of didn't really reciprocate. But, you know, we mentioned this on the last episode, too. When David met all of his artistic friends and confidants, like the Andy Warhol crowd, they all thought that his wife, Angie, was like the really interesting, cool, innovative one. And they thought that David was kind of like this mousy, meek drip was the word that they used. So, yeah, his relationship with his wife, Angie, was really very fascinating. They almost seemed like, it reminds me of the relationship between Frank Underwood and his wife, whose name escapes me, on House of Cards. Like, it seemed very much like an arranged union of power.
Yeah. She does not have good things to say about him in Please Kill Me. Which I was leafing through for this. Yeah. It's so funny. She basically, for all of the, and they had a very open marriage, for all of the people that either one of them slept with while they were together, the person who sort of broke up their marriage was Iggy Pop. Because she was just like, I did not like that friendship. Great music came out of it, though. Anyway, she was caught off guard by this. She said, you could have at least said you were bisexual. But predictably, the story kicked off a widespread debate about the exact nature of David's sexual identity. Was this a proud declaration of sexual independence, or was it just an easy way to garner some inches in the columns? As with most things, the truth lies probably somewhere in the middle. David was the son of a PR man. His first straight job, that bad wordplay, had been in advertising. And, you know, throughout his entire career, he's just sort of been a master at getting the press to kind of dance at his tempo.
Well, I think the thing that's important to note is that he'd been trying to break into the music world since 1964, 65. So this is like 7 years at this point. So he was kind of on the sidelines watching other people do it, watching what worked. So he was not only had, you know, 7 years of studying how the game was played, but he was also a lot older than the big 60s stars who broke on through. I mean, the Beatles, the Who, the Kinks, and the big bands that, you know, were getting huge when he first was trying to break into the industry in the mid 60s were in their late teens, really. And now Bowie was like 25. So he was much more sophisticated in the art of media manipulation and much more savvy. So I think that's an important thing to note. He was a half a generation removed from all the big 60s stars. And I think that half generation, that 5, 6, 7 year period made a huge difference.
Yeah, and he was always just sort of, along with aliens and jazz, the gays were another big parlor fascination for him. You know, on the road, Kerouac, the Beats have some queer themes running through that entire genre. Obviously, Allen Ginsberg is a huge figure in that. John Rishi's City of Night. And as a teen, he would make claims to his bandmates that he was bisexual. But a lot of different people have thrown around words like opportunist, narcissist, contrived. Watts, who wrote that article, said, personally, I think he was lying. I think he said it for effect as much as anything else. He is a master at misleading the press and creating headlines as a result. And then 4 years later, David talked to him again, which was possibly a mistake, and denied the whole thing. Bisexual? Oh, Lord, no. Positively not, he said, which sounds like he's like clutching actual pearls as he said that. That was just a lie. I never adopted that stance. It was given to me. I've never done a bisexual action in my life, on stage, on record, or anywhere else.
This sounds sarcastic.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, like camp. Like he's like winking as he says it. Later that same year, he told Playboy, it's true, I am bisexual, but I can't deny I have used that fact very well. I suppose it's the best thing that ever happened to me. Then in the 80s, he would characterize his homosexual declaration as the biggest mistake I ever made and advise fans not to believe everything that they read.
The 80s period really lost him a fair amount of fans because that was sort of the era when he... This is the era when he became MTV famous, and famous in a way that he'd really never been. For all of his artistic breakthroughs all throughout the 70s, when he started doing Let's Dance and getting the video for China Girl played on MTV and stuff, that was a whole different level of like mall fame that he'd never really been. And so he, I mean, again, he looks like the perfect pop star for Reagan's America. And he kind of started to walk back a lot of his things that would mark him as different from the mainstream. And one of that was his sexual stance. And I have a lot of friends who talk about that period in a really disparaging way because it was just because they thought that he was abandoning them.
Yeah. And then like 10 years later in the 90s, he's saying, I think I was always a closet heterosexual. Yeah, fun turn of phrase there. I was physical about it, but frankly, it wasn't enjoyable. It was almost like I was testing myself. For me, I was more magnetized by the whole gay scene. It was like another world that I really wanted to buy into. Oh, there's the quote. I didn't sell out. I bought in. And then, like we said, Angie, a fair amount of score settling, axe grinding, and Please Kill Me, she says, when David said in Melody Maker that he was gay, then he changed it and said he was bisexual, which is what he really meant. He never would have had the balls to do that unless he'd been hanging around with Iggy Pop and Lou Reed, because they represented this place across the ocean where things were changing. So as an American woman, you know, she kind of painted that statement and his whole stance there as sort of a byway of his fascination with American culture. And in particular, you know, Lou Reed and Iggy Moore, who were both kind of dabbling in pushing those boundaries themselves. Although in an extremely not famous way. I mean, they were both such fringe figures by at this point.
So things were changing in the States, but they were changing a lot more slowly in the UK. And a lot of David's friends were really concerned that he ruined his career with this announcement in Melody Maker that he was gay in early 1972. And obviously he did meet with some resistance, especially actually ironically later on when he did come to the States, when a lot of Southern program directors refused to play him or allow him on their show for interviews. One station manager even said to him, "We don't have perverts on this show."
Just racists.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's really funny because Alice Cooper had made the transition from dresses and high heels to embracing the full on gore and horror in his set. So blood and dead babies were fine in America, but not a man in a dress. I think that is America in 1972 and maybe 2022. And during the Ziggy shows, David incorporated a bit of stage business where he'd throw himself at Mick Ronson's feet during the guitar solo in Suffragette City. And the photographer Mick Rock, the recently departed brilliant photographer, rock photographer Mick Rock, incredible name, incredible talent, captured this moment for posterity where Bowie is on his knees at Ronson's feet as he's playing a solo. David's face is notably near Ronson's crotch.
There are many photos of this.
Right, right. But there's this one in particular that David loved so much that he ran it as a full page advertisement in the music press. And it was supposedly a thank you to his fans and staff. It was basically an advertisement for himself. A look how outrageous I am picture that he paid to have placed in the music press. But the stunt had the unintended consequence of making life difficult for Mick Ronson and his family, who all endured shouts of various homophobic slurs. Paint was thrown on the Ronson's front door and even on the new car that Mick had just bought them. So, I mean, things were a lot slower to change in England than some parts of America, I should say, in the early 70s. And this all kind of gets to a larger question of, was Bowie good for the LGBTQ community? Many in the burgeoning gay rights community regarded David as a hero. And this always made David really uneasy. And he was very happy to encourage people to be themselves, let their freak flag fly, so to speak. But he saw himself as an artist rather than an activist, and he didn't want to become a lightning rod for socio-political causes. For all of the personas that David would inhabit over the years, he never adopted that of a radicalized street-fighting man. And this disappointed some people in the LGBTQ world who felt betrayed and in some cases even used by David as he began to walk back his seemingly proud sexual declaration in the 80s, like I just mentioned. But despite this complicated alliance, it's impossible to downplay the impact that David had in bringing gay culture to the mainstream. And to this point, homosexuals in mass media were basically punchlines and stereotypes. David projected strength, talent, youth, and success. And to quote the designer Jean-Paul Gaultier, he gave many the courage not to hide. And that went for homosexuals and also really anyone who deviated from the norm. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more Too Much Information in just a moment.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, we had just talked about Angie saying that America was kind of a long-standing promised land for David. And so we come to the first American tour, September 1972, complicated slightly by the fact that David refused to fly. If it flies, it's death, was his mantra. He refused to stay in hotel rooms higher than the fourth floor because he had a real problem with heights. So he took an ocean liner, the QE2. The ocean liner.
Yeah, really.
From England to New York at great expense. Did we talk about DeFries last time?
Tony DeFries. No, we have DeFries. Not. Probably the biggest wheeler dealer manager this side of Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker. He is quite a character. And he's still alive. So we should be very careful.
So we'll pepper in some of his greatest hits as we go. But he decided to play up this phobia, actually, because Zeppelin has their famous jet with the logo plastered on it. Elton John had a private jet. But David has an ocean liner. And it's interesting. I was just reading in the Doggett book, The Man Who Sold the World, about how the 20s and 30s were kind of coming back into vogue at this time, at least for a certain hipster intelligentsia in Britain, because they were kind of retreating back even further than World War II to this, what they saw as kind of this last era of glamour. So anyway, an ocean liner would play into that.
I think this was around, when did The Great Gatsby movie with Redford come out? I think it was 73, 74. So around the same time, you're right.
It's DeFries, right?
I think it's DeFries, yeah.
Yeah. His strategy with David could best be described as fake it till you make it. For years, any British act who wanted to break into the United States kind of had to start from scratch. They would schlep around these tiny venues, play third on the bill, supporting American acts, and try and just build buzz by really just hitting the bricks. And DeFries planned to skip all that, just cut the line. David Bowie would arrive on American shores as an A-lister. He insisted that David would never open for anyone, but always headline, which I wasn't that also a thing in Proviso and Hendrix and The Who? That was like the big power move at the time, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, that might have been the power move for them, but I don't think he would write clauses into his performance contract demanding the largest grand piano in any city that he was playing for his gig.
They wouldn't even name it. They'd just be like, whenever the biggest one is, give us that thing.
Well, anything less than 9 feet would result in the immediate cancellation of his performance.
Yeah, just a couple other choice bits from the writers. If a venue didn't have a private walkway from the entrance to the dressing room, they would have to build one so that David could remain unseen. And he was expected to live up this image on his end as well. He was booked into the highest end hotels so that David could get used to the VIP treatment.
Oh, it was like training. This was before he was on tour. He would spend weekends at extremely high end London hotels to get used to having people wait on him and stuff.
Yeah, and they gave him a large Yorkshireman named Stewie George, who was hired as his personal bodyguard, and they would actually rehearse leaving venues in a hurry, like the scene from The Bodyguard. I don't know if he was actually carried a la Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston, but he would sprint outside into one of three vans, one real one and two decoys that would be idling outside of the venue. It's really insane.
He grew up with A Hard Day's Night. This is like all the Hard Day's Night fantasies and stuff.
Yeah. George is a wacky guy. He gave an interview to The Sun recently that fed this constant music industry scuttlebutt that Bowie and Mick Jagger used to sleep together all the time. Adding the fascinating variation on that ballet dancer Rudolf Nureyev was banned from a very specific threesome that the pair had with an unnamed famous British female singer. I don't know why he was locked out of that, but it's not the first time that there's an overlap between Mick Jagger and Nureyev. Christopher Anderson's bio of Jagger called Mick, the Wildlife and Mad Genius of Jagger, includes the claim that Nureyev and Jagger playfully trapped Geraldo Rivera in the middle of a sexual sandwich at a party. I don't know what that means. Maybe they just ran up on him and started grinding on him, but Rivera claimed that this was Mick's serious attempt to seduce him. So there's your Mick Jagger weird sex stuff corner. Now, tell us about main man, Jordan.
Yes. To aid in his American assault, Tony DeFries set up a field office in New York City for his newly formed management company called Main Man.
One word.
One word, Main Man. And the expensive offices in Midtown Manhattan were basically a stage set designed to project strength, importance, and above all, success. Again, this is a guy with no hit records in the United States. But the rooms, they were all decorated with elegant leather armchairs and framed portraits of David and expensive stationery, and everything looked amazing. But the suggestion of immense wealth was purely a facade. DeFries was very much of the you need to spend money to make money, and he knew how to spend money. He took a kind of similar approach with his employees, who were hired more or less because they looked cool rather than for any professional skills. The New York main office was staffed with basically a cast of freaks from Andy Warhol. Well, yeah, the cast of Pork, Andy Warhol's play. When we use that term loosely, they were all Warhol's factory freaks, and they were urged to act and look like $1 million. And this involved pretending that they had $1 million. So they were turned loose with company credit cards and encouraged to pay for lavish meals with huge groups of industry insiders. There were fleets of limousines kept on constant call. And on top of their $100 a week salary, which was decent back then, staffers had their rent paid. And you know who else had their rent paid? A group known as the FODs, or Friends of David, who were people who had no tangible role within the company, but they were taken care of anyway.
Yeah, Lee Childers says in Please Kill Me that DeFries and Tony Zanetta took him out to dinner and made the decision that he would be the VP of the company just based on their dinner conversation. And then he promptly installed Cherry Vanilla, another factory figure, as the secretary. Which is an incredible time. They had no idea what they were doing and just doing it on RCA's dime.
Oh, it was amazing. Yeah. I mean, and the best part is in order to add this extra layer of mystique around David, Tony DeFries turned down basically all interviews by this point in late 1972. And instead, the aforementioned Cherry Vanilla, who is a factory, she did have a background in PR, but she was mostly a denizen of Warhol's factory, would give interviews, but she would just make outrageous claims about him being like a communists and all this other stuff. And during one, she claimed that David made a point to sleep with everyone who worked for him. And the following day, the main man offices were flooded with job applications. But again, the employees were better at looking cool than being productive. And as you mentioned, DeFreeze drafted the Andy Warhol acolyte named Tony Zanetta to act as tour manager for this U.S. tour. But the title meant absolutely nothing to Tony Zanetta, who asked, "What does a road manager do?" And Tony DeFreeze, David's manager, just kind of annoyed by the question, just said, just make sure they find Cleveland, which is where the tour was due to kick off.
Yeah, he Zanetta claims on the Diamond Dogs tour, he was partying in a hotel with a bunch of these A-listers, and they knocked on the door, and they're like, "It's the cops." And everyone just drops their drugs on the carpet, and then he got arrested for it because the room is in his name. I just love that. Like, just a coordinated thing. Everyone just drops a bunch of blow and weed and whatever else on the floor. So they walk in, it's just a bunch of celebrities, like, standing around, like, just studiously ignoring a drug-littered shag carpet. That's how I imagine it, anyway.
But, thankfully, Tony Zanetta and the Bowie crew did find Cleveland, where Bowie made his American debut on September 22nd, 1972. And this momentous occasion was nearly a total loss after organizers failed to provide a properly huge baby grand piano.
They under were, 9 feet.
Yeah, they were not messing around. They were going to completely scuttle his American debut until they found an appropriately enormous set of keys borrowed from the city symphony orchestra. But thankfully, other than that, his American debut went off without a hitch. But something really interesting happened afterward. David met a 21-year-old fan from Akron, Ohio named Chrissy Hind, who's the future front woman of the Pretenders. And she and her friends chauffeured David around the rest of the night in her mother's Oldsmobile to, like, a local diner and hung out. I love pre-fame rock stars hanging out. And I love that he was so not big that he could just meet up with some fans and go out to a diner in Cleveland. I love this so much. So that's some good old-fashioned American hospitality. But this hospitality was taken to its illogical conclusion when...
Yeah, they had a lot of fun on this tour in different ways. They would love to just crash these hotel cocktail lounges late at night in their full makeup and costume just to see the looks of everybody as they kind of strutted in looking and sounding like aliens. Because if you're in Cleveland, you probably... Isn't it? I think it's Lou Reed who... Mick Ronson plays on the Transformers, the Transformer tour with him. And I think it's in the classic albums for Transformer that he's like, "I couldn't understand a single word he said."
Yeah, it is that.
All these like Northern English guys come in and it's just like, "If you're in Cleveland, you have not heard that accent before." Yeah, and so Zanetta got a call one morning that, David just had gone missing. All the gear is packed, the crew's ready to go. David is nowhere to be found. And so, thankfully, he gets another phone call from David, who also has no idea where he is, and gives him the wonderful description, "I'm in a house. There are trees everywhere. I think I'm in the middle of a forest."
It's one of my favorite Bowie stories, period.
Honestly, kudos to the bellhop at the hotel who somehow manages to work out where he is based on that. But then they found him happy. So all's well that ends it well. But, you know, the stories of the stuff they got up to on this tour are endless and usually related to sex stuff. You know, once at a party, Bowie sets his sight on a woman who is dancing with disgusting garbage person Kim Fowley, one of the worst people in the LA music scene. And David sidles up to him and politely asks, "Are you in love with this woman, or may I take her into the bathroom?" And he responded in the negative.
I'm pretty sure the woman was like overhearing all of this. I think she was like right there listening.
They probably talked about her as if she wasn't there.
Yeah.
And receiving no objection, David then turns to her and says, "How do you do? I'm David Bowie. I'd like to discuss life or the universal whatever, my dear." And takes her by the hand and they go off looking for a restroom. David Bowie, bat in 1,000.
My favorite 70s rock star pickup line, I think edging that out, belongs to Mick Jagger, who used to ask people, "Do you prefer to wake up in the city or the country?" And that would decide whether or not they would take him to his London townhouse in Chelsea or his baronial manor, Star Groves, in the British countryside.
Jagger. Many people who knew David during this time have posited that he was possibly suffering, maybe not suffering per se, from sex addiction. One person who knew him would describe him with less than charitable brio as screwing everything that moved and quite a bit that didn't. And this got taken to its illogical conclusion one night at his hotel when some creepy wheeler dealer in Hollywood offered to procure a dead body for his pleasure. Still warm, if he liked. David, thankfully, was deeply horrified and rejected the indecent overture.
I'm going to guess it was Kim Fowley. I'm just going to, in my mind, I'm imagining it was Kim Fowley.
Oh, almost certainly. All right, getting into weird, gross stuff. Let's tread carefully here.
Speaking of deeply upsetting moments, we would be remiss not to mention the troubling claim of Lori Maddox, who was a member of the so-called baby groupies, a term I don't like. They were a clique of teenagers who hung around with visiting musicians who roamed the Sunset Strip clubs at night. And Maddox is probably most famous for her very tempestuous relationship with Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page while she was still a minor. Prior to that, she said that she lost her virginity to Bowie during the Ziggy Stardust tour when she was 15 years old and David was 26. Now, her version of events has varied considerably over the years and occasionally features historical impossibilities, leading some to doubt her story, but she's repeated the general gist for decades and tells her tale with utmost fondness. She said, "I remember him looking like God. Who wouldn't want to lose their virginity to David Bowie?" And to this day, Maddox claims that her experience with Bowie wasn't only consensual, those are her words, but also a cherished memory, which creates a thorny moral quandary for herself and also Bowie's fans. Now, Maddox has always rebuffed those who sought to label her a victim, and while she admits that her perception has shifted following the rise of the Me Too movement, she still denies that she was ever taken advantage of by Bowie. And her quote is, "We were friends. It was all pure fun. It was a different time in rock and roll." And in that era, some of the world's most famous rock stars shamelessly engaged in relationships with young girls. Some of these women have no regrets, and others remain scarred by their experience. And at the time, it was just an accepted part of the Hollywood music scene. I guess I'm glad that it's a positive memory for her.
Segway.
Yeah. Hollywood was, as you might expect, the scene of the most extreme excesses on the Ziggy Stardust tour. The Bowie entourage stay at the Beverly Hills Hotel cost $100,000, including $20,000 in room service bills alone. And this is 1972. It's a lot of money now, but that's serious money then.
Yeah. Childers basically says, admirably, they basically bullied RCA into doing this.
Yeah.
It was easier for a huge company of like RCA to give us whatever we wanted than to listen to us, he says. And please, again, and please kill me. They didn't want us there at all. So I'd just come in with this blonde hair flying and say, "I need 14 tickets to Kansas City." And they go, "Okay, fine. You got them. Just go away." It was a totally unheard of tactic, but it worked. We lived off the credit. I have no idea how much we went into debt with RCA, but of course, the philosophy was, once you went so far into debt, they didn't dare cut you off, because then they'd never make it back again.
Yes, the tour's sole concession to cost-cutting was to decree that groupies, quote, be sent home without breakfast. And Lee Childers, who was part of the Warhol crowd that got absorbed into the Bowie main man management madness, apparently doesn't know how much they went into debt. I do. In all, the 71-day tour cost roughly $7,000 a day and lost $485,000, which directly resulted in the cancellation of RCA Records' annual Christmas bonus to help pay that off.
Yeah, so he says he arrived at the Beverly Hills Hotel 3 or 4 days before the entirety of the entourage, 48 people at the Beverly Hills Hotel. The funniest thing, quote, was that the roadies would go up to the Sunset Strip and pick up tourists and bring them back to their rooms and order dinner on room service, and then the roadies would pay them for the dinner, which sounds like a scam from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. All of our expenses were paid for, so the roadies would go to the strip 3 or 4 times a day, bring back these tourists, sit them down in their room, and serve them these fabulous lobster dinners with chocolate souffles, and then charge the tourists for it. So the tourists were getting, like, I guess, essentially at a discount, room service at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and the roadie, and that was pure profit for the roadies. Just an incredible series of events. But At least they got a record out of it, right, Jordan?
Yes. RCA got a new album. It was during Bowie's first American tour in late 1972 that he wrote the bulk of what would become Aladdin Sane, which Bowie would describe as Ziggy Goes to America, dispatches from his alien alter ego on the road. It was basically a sequel album, although musically very different, thanks to the addition of pianist Mike Garson, who added these incredible, like, cracked cabaret piano flourishes. He's an incredible player. And they recorded that album that winter, the winter of 73, and it was due for release in the spring of 73, around the same time that the Ziggy Stardust tour went to Japan.
Yes! Much like Tom Waits, David Bowie was big in Japan.
Yes. Yeah, it's really funny. Ziggy Stardust had been selling nonstop in Japan despite almost no promotional effort whatsoever. It remained in the charts over there for 2 years. And I guess when you think about it, the attraction was kind of understandable. Their culture, the Japanese culture, had been a major part of Ziggy Stardust's DNA. David had been drawn to Japanese styles and colors and textures while designing Ziggy's costumes, creating a look that, in a quite literal sense, was alien to Western audiences. And most notable are the outfits that Bowie commissioned from the future fashion icon Kansai Yamamoto, who designed the most famous Ziggy outfits, the kimonos and the big kind of bear-like outfits and stuff.
Yeah, he had his first London show in 1971, and we had talked a little bit about Ziggy's hair last time, and here's what Bowie had to say about Yamamoto's influence on that. Quote, he had just unleashed all the kabuki and no inspired clothes on London, and one of his models had the kabuki lion's mane on her head, this bright red thing. And Yamamoto would say of Bowie, in a bit of wry Japanese understatement, he has an unusual face. He's neither man nor woman.
I mean, to the Japanese, Bowie was like a rocked up, larger than life reflection of their own cultural heritage. And they illustrated this point quite literally when they welcomed him to Japan with a massive 90-foot poster of his face, which I think was inducted into the Guinness Book of World Records as the largest poster in the world ever at the time. It was hung from a Tokyo skyscraper.
Yeah, so two things. One, the NO theater is N-O-H, and probably one of the visual touchstones from that that's going to be most familiar to Western audiences is that was the inspiration for David Byrne's big suit. They have these very squared off wardrobe, I mean, they're kimonos, but they're very squared off looking stylized fashions in their productions. And that was David Byrne had gotten into that on the Stop Making Sense era. And was, his whole big suit thing was trying to look like a square with a tiny little head.
Yeah, kabuki is really fascinating. And this whole tour allowed David to really delve more into it. For anyone who doesn't know, it's a Japanese theatrical style. The word kabuki is a word that means song, dance, art, which is, you know, kind of the perfect word to describe what David was trying to do with the Ziggy Stardust project. And it's characterized by elaborate makeup, garish costumes, and physical expressionism, which, you know, again, it's easy to see why kabuki would appeal to David. And in many ways, it's the Eastern counterpart to the mime work that David had done back in the 60s. He studied with a very famous performer named Lindsay Kemp. And it's also interesting because kabuki performers were exclusively male, so they played both men and women, sometimes in the same scene, rapidly changing costumes to express this change of personality. So for David, a man who swapped personas like clothes as the mood suited him, this was very compelling. And his trip to Japan had a very marked influence on his performances because he assumed that the Japanese audiences didn't understand his lyrics. He delivered these incredibly physical performances, probably the most physically demanding shows of his life up to that point, activating his songs with his hands and his body. And due in part to this physical exertion, he started performing part of the show in what was basically a red sequin jockstrap. And the sight of this whipped the crowd into a frenzy. And at one point, he was forced to barricade himself in his dressing room for hours after the show because the audience was more or less stampeding. So yeah,
so horny. So horny. As you meditate on that, we'll be right back with more Too Much Information after these messages.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern-day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season. And guess what? So are we. Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a six-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last two decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rolling right along. David Bowie famously retired Ziggy at the height of this insanity, and the reasons for it are legion. So first and foremost, he's just physically tired. Year and a half of touring runs you ragged, especially doing this extremely physical mime-influenced stuff. His costumes are literally coming apart at the seams. You know, Doggett talks a lot about this. I'm sure people in his circle talked a lot about this, but, you know, he was skin and bones at that point. He was barely topping 100 pounds, and he was not a short guy either, so... Yeah. During a gig at Radio City Music Hall in February, he collapsed and he just wanted to stay home. But DeFries booked him to play 60 concerts in 52 days across Britain and pitching a third U.S. tour in just under a year, plus shows in China and Russia. And, you know, you mentioned a little bit about he's not quite as drug addled at this point, but Doggett does say each successive week of this period saw him ingesting more cocaine and less food.
You understand why when you see, I mean, 60 concerts in 52 days. That's insane.
Yeah, it's insane. The tour routing from this, it's like so many of these guys, that's why they had vocal cord surgery. And it's like why, you know, he did lose a big chunk of his upper register.
Did he?
Robert Plant. If you listen to that Glasto show, he's not really doing, he can still do like the falsetto stuff, but. Yeah, it's bad, dude. Elton John had nodes surgery.
Yeah,
Robert Plant's voice was shot by like 5 years into Zeppelin. Like, I mean, they were also smoking and doing, you know, stepped on cocaine. Facet number two, the spider. Spiders! The spiders, the relationship with the spiders are breaking down. There are a lot of reasons, but as always, it comes back to filthy lucre. And, you know, David's also distancing himself from this at this point while also getting closer to Mick Ronson. The pay thing is wacky. Garson is the most recent hire into the band, and he got a much better rate than Boulder and Woodmansey because they were kind of grandfathered into a lower pay rate. They're on a plane one day, and Woody is paging through a magazine. He sees an ad for a Lamborghini. And he's like, oh, I love that car. And Garson says, why don't you get it? You can afford it. And this leads into an awkward moment where they compare their pay. And Woodmansey told the BBC in 2012, Garson was getting paid three times what he was. And I guess I just found this. He said, the final straw was DeFries saying to us, I would rather pay the road crew more than you. So that'll do a number on the tight camaraderie of peeing in pub sinks together.
I mean, that seems like it's the old manager trick of trying to like split the singer from the band and yeah. have the singer go solo so that, you know, there's less money that has to be divided up. So, I mean, it almost seems like he's intentionally trying to be as crass and sow the seeds of dissent.
Yeah. And again, man, I just can't be stressed how great those guys truly were. Just such a great meat and potatoes rhythm section that band is. So things get so bad that Woodmansey and Trevor Boulder, the bassist, are barely talking to David. And they boycotted shows until Mick Ronson basically begs them to come back.
And speaking of filthy lucre, another problem for the Ziggy Stardust tour is that they stopped selling. David, well, maybe more Tony DeFries than David, had violated the first rule of show business, which is always leave them wanting more. Bowie had taken so many trips across England, across the United States, that he basically eliminated demand to see him. And American seats were going unsold. Promoters were worrying about making a return on their investment. Plus, the American tours never made any money anyway. We mentioned that the first American tour was almost $500,000 in debt. So these tours were basically a PR move. They increased David's fame, but decreased his bank account. And this had been DeFries' plan from the start, but the spending was spiraling out of control. And tours were on average making back less than a quarter of what they spent. And then plus, David's stubborn refusal to fly meant that he could only play a limited number of shows anyway. So there was only so much that they could do to recoup their expenses. RCA Records refused to underwrite another tour, and Main Man Management didn't have the money to mount the tour themselves. They were hemorrhaging money to the tune of £1,000 a week they were losing. And Bowie himself, for all of his growing fame at this point, he didn't have the money. There were times when they would get back home after a tour and find that the door to their home had been padlocked shut by creditors, and they would send their young son to stay with friends just so they could be, you know, ensured that he had regular meals and stuff. So Bowie didn't have any money. And finally, another reason why David needed to kill Ziggy was that just purely from an artistic standpoint, he felt stifled by Ziggy. And for the first time, I think David, who'd wanted success for the better part of a decade at this point, finally realized the downside to having a hit on this scale. When he was basically a nobody, he could explore creatively to his heart's content. Now, with these fans, there was an expectation. An expectation is the artist's archenemy. He would later say, I felt for the first time and the only time that I was working for someone else. And his Ziggy Stardust follow-up, Aladdin Sane, was basically a sequel. And David hated to repeat himself creatively. And this time, he ceded to label pressure and popular demand, and he made this album that was very similar to the sound and style of Ziggy Stardust. He'd created an alter ego, and it had completely taken over his life. It was like a cancer. It just grew and grew and threatened to kill the host. Audiences, journalists, label executives, even his own entourage, they all wanted Ziggy, not David Jones. So David just simply played Ziggy at all times, and it really messed with his mental state. He became lost in the fantasy. He was insulated from a normal daily life by his coterie of handlers, the security guards, and all the sycophants who DeFries kind of put in place specifically to make him feel like a star. And now he just was treated like this alien who was in constant need of protection. And as a result, David, to be blunt, lost touch with reality. And he gave a quote in later years, the doppelganger and myself were starting to become one and the same person. Then you start on the trail of chaotic psychological destruction. So it was really a case of David phasing out Ziggy before Ziggy phased out him. And so David decided to kill him off, or retire him, which was better to keep his options open. And it really seemed like the perfect solution to all of David's personal and professional problems, because in the short term, it would excuse him from all the upcoming tour dates, which he was too tired to do anyway, and were also shaping up to be a financial disaster, poorly attended. By canceling these dates for creative reasons and not economic ones, he could save face and not look like a failure. And it actually would do quite the opposite. It would bolster his reputation as an unclassifiable artistic enigma, because who else would abandon their star-making persona? It made him look like a daring and adventurous creator rather than some guy who was just exhausted and overexposed. So the whole retirement idea was a stroke of public relations genius because it offered David creative freedom and the well-deserved rest. The Beatles had retired from the road in 1966 at the peak of their career, so why not David? The one person who objected to David retiring, ironically, was, not ironically, but just interestingly, was Bob Dylan. Dylan talked about this on an episode of his Theme Time radio show in recent years. He said, David told every... I can't... Can you do it, Bob Dylan?
David told everyone he was going to retire after the Ziggy Stardust tour.
I remember that.
I remember that. I told him not to do it.
That's good.
He sounds like the f***ing Crypt Keeper these days, though, because he's such a chain smoker.
Yeah, so I can't imagine Dylan and Ziggy, shall we say, interacting in this stage. But yeah,
no.
Guess Dylan told him not to
retire. You should buy a motorcycle.
So, yeah, but I guess for not the last time, Bowie didn't listen.
So arrangements are made for the final bow, which would take place on the last day of the tour, which is, you know, one of the better ones, a sold-out gig at the Hammersmith Odeon on July 3rd, 1973. The plan was top secret, kept strictly between David and DeFries. Not even Angie was told about it, and neither was half the band. Ronson was tipped off, but he has said at one point, in the end, it was almost a last-minute decision. But Woody and Trevor were not. After nearly 3 years of just being thick as thieves,
That's awful.
Summarily dismissed on stage. Nowadays, you get called into HR. Back in the day, they would have just done it to you on stage. D.A. Pennebaker, second Dylan connection, did Don't Look Back, was hired to document the proceedings at one point. They sent the famous Rolling Stones mobile recording studio. And this must have been insane. Pennebaker apparently had signs posted around the Hammersmith Odeon that told the crowd to bring flash cameras and take as many photos as they possibly could. Good Lord. Can you imagine being in a sold out Hammersmith Odeon with many, 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 many people in the crowd having flash cameras? Yeah. Imagine being on stage with that and high on cocaine. And wearing a jock strap.
Talk about a stressful show. I mean,
yeah.
Sold out hometown gig. Recording a live album, incredibly famous documentarian filming you. David was understandably very stressed out before the show. And there's this really interesting story from a woman named Julie. And she confirmed it to me when I was doing this Bowie podcast. She had tickets to what would become known forevermore as the Ziggy Stardust farewell concert when she was just 13. And before the show, in amongst all the teenage Bowie clones outside, she spotted the real thing pacing outside the venue. Totally alone. No one had spotted him. Because I guess everyone's dressed like David Bowie. It's almost like a Where's Waldo thing. It's like, oh, wait a minute. That's the real one. So she approached him and was really just going to go say, you know, hi and offer words of praise and thanks. But according to her, he started to break down and he'd fled his dressing room a few moments before just to get some peace outside. And he just started unloading on this young girl, saying that he was worried that he was going crazy. He didn't know who he was anymore. His marriage was going wrong. His finances were a mess. It was such a funny little private moment between Bowie at this critical juncture in his career and this teenage fan. And then he spots some roadies looking for him and he bounds off inside, which must have been terrifying. He wants a moment of peace and you see these presumably huge road manager people off stalking out looking for you. So he runs back inside and watches his fans enter the theater from the balcony like some fascist dictator. But yeah, as you mentioned, the rhythm section, Woody Woodmansey and Trevor Boulder found out on stage that they were fired. It was just before the traditional show closer, Rock and Roll Suicide, and David gave a little moment on stage where he thanked the road crew and the band. And you can see him in the footage almost imperceptibly pause before plunging the knife into his most successful creation and into the backs of some of his closest associates. He said, "Of all the shows in this tour, this particular show will remain with us longest because not only is it the last show of the tour, but it's the last show we'll ever do. Thank you." And the Spiders are all looking at each other as they're starting the song, like, wait,
what
did he just say? And it's worth noting, Rock and Roll Suicide, long song. And they're all kind of looking at each other, mouthing at each other, like, wait, did we just get sacked? And Woody Wibbenzig later said that he considered storming off in the middle of the song, but managed to keep his composure to play through. But after taking their final bows, they looked in vain for David to get some kind of an explanation. And according to them, he was nowhere to be found.
Ugh, I can't.
It's pretty brutal. He can be brutal. When he was done with people, he was done. I know we talked in the prior episode about what an incredible music fan he was. And if he liked your music, he remained a fan for life. For as sweet as he could be to the artists that he loved and admired, when he was done, it was like flicking a switch. He was done.
Yeah, I have no segue for that, but Jeff Beck was there?
Oh, yeah.
Can Jeff Beck play guitar on two of these songs? The movie didn't get released until 83, and I guess Beck asked not to be in it because he felt out of place, which is kind of funny.
That's interesting.
Other notes, Marlena Dietrich and Ringo Starr were both in the audience.
I think Lulu, too.
Yeah. I hope they were all there together. Oh. It's a fun little triptych. Yeah.
The press reaction to David's news was monumental. And I had heard actually that DeFries and David had actually tipped off a few key journalists to prep stories so that they would go. Actually, I heard that the story was actually going to press before the concert was even over. So, there's all sorts of stories about how far in advance this was prepped. But the news when it was over and done was huge, especially because of a press release that David's management company put out that dramatically said that David was leaving the concert stage forever. And it would take weeks before it kind of became clear that they weren't talking about David himself, but Ziggy. Ziggy was the one who wasn't going to perform again.
Yeah, and he said he was making this pivot to movies. He was going to adapt Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. 3 years later, he stars in The Man Who Fell to Earth. It really does seem like they were positioning him for a pivot to film. You know, even in the one press release, Main Man said that David Bowie would be writing the script for his own future. So,
but as sad as it was for his bandmates and for all the legion of fans who love Ziggy Stardust, Bowie was free. All of his obligations, performance-wise, were all up in smoke. A year, almost to the day after his star-making appearance on Top of the Pops, David had carried out the self-immolation foretold in the Ziggy Stardust narrative. It was a real-life rock and roll suicide. Through the act of killing Ziggy, David put the master stroke on his most enduring work of art. And I just find this really funny. For years, Bowie apparently wouldn't look at tapes of himself performing as Ziggy Stardust. But when he finally did, he thought they were hilarious. And I love that. And I just think that's a perfect spot to end because people forget how damn funny he was. And, you know, I mentioned this in the first episode. It's funny. David was not one of my go-to people growing up, but he always cropped up in my life in very strange ways. The first article I was ever asked to write for Rolling Stone was about Bowie, and iHeart asked me to do this Bowie biography podcast. And there's some strange force that keeps bringing him to me. And that seems to be the case when I spoke to numerous Bowie superfans for the show I was working on. There's something almost supernatural there. So it felt right to honor the 50th anniversary of his breakthrough with All We Got, this two-part episode. Plus, like I said, also in the last episode, Bowie people were the best. The Bowie fans were the most kind, supportive people, and I wanted to do right by them. So I salute them, and I salute the Starman, too, with this episode. I had a lot of fun. Well, we had a lot of fun because it's not only the last show of this Bowie episode, it's the last show we'll ever do. Just kidding.
This ain't a podcast. This is suicide. Thanks for listening, folks. I'm Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Runtog. We'll catch you next time. Too Much Information was a production of iHeartRadio.
The show's executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog.
The supervising producer is Mike Johns.
The show was researched, written, and hosted by Jordan Runtog and Alex Heigl.
With original music by Seth Applebaum and the Ghost Funk Orchestra. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Ladies and gentlemen.
We are coming back to Atlanta. Right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.